Saturday. It looks like a little, perhaps an increased chance of thunderstorms. Not a lot when we come into Saturday night, but high near 89, about 20% during the day. But in the evening, about a 30% chance of thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, low around 62. Sunday, partly sunny, and it's chance of thunderstorms staying about 30%, high about 86, a little cooling trend Sunday night, 30% chance of showers, low around 60. And Monday is projected to be mostly sunny, high about 85 Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around 55. And Tuesday, again, about a 20% chance of thunderstorms. So it's that time of year when we see the transition from wet to dry. I'm going to play a little bit of music and get back with our guest here in the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I just picked out some new music from the KRFP studios, somebody named Katie Guthorn, and we're just going to play one of these songs. So here we go.
You only, I can be so
And we are back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I just want to make sure that you're coming in. Ronnie, can you talk there?
Gary, how are we doing?
Looks like, oh boy, we've got a little problem here. So I'm going to plug in our, just go through another song here and see if we can't get this solved. We'll play another little tune here. Looks like we're having a little bit of technical difficulty. So here we go with another a song from that CD.
That I am. the luckiest.
And we are back, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. How are you doing there, Ronnie?
I'm well, thanks, Gary.
Okay, good.
We're not getting
Any sound.
How's that now?
I don't know. Is it?
Yeah, it looks like it's pretty good.
There it is, yeah.
Looks like we're coming through now. Well, thanks for coming on the show today. I'm going to give a brief introduction of you, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but I sort of think of you as sort of the Renaissance man of the Palouse. You've got so much experience in so many fields. You're a PhD from, is it Harvard that you went?
No, to Yale.
Yale, okay. It was one of the Ivy League schools. And you taught...
It's in politics.
It's in political science.
International
political science. And you've also taught in Australia, at universities in Australia, and also in Indonesia.
That's right, yes.
So you've got a very broad experience, besides teaching over here at Washington State University.
And I also taught at the U of I for a
couple
of years.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So you've sort of been all over the place, and but you have your sort of you're involved in so many different things. I wanted to talk about a couple things, if we can start off some local things, and then maybe expand a little bit and get your take on maybe some of this international stuff and tie it back to local issues, because we were talking earlier about the so-called problem that you read an article, the Papuan problem. And I'd like to kind of end with that. But I'll talk a little bit about maybe your place and some of the unique diversity that's found just to our west in Whitman County. And you have some unique Palouse Prairie remnants, I guess, on your place, or at least you found some plants I know that were fairly rare.
Yes, there's something like about 1% of the Palouse is still comprised largely of native plants, a lot of invasive species among them, especially all the highest points, all the buttes, for example, and the Moscow Mountain, of course. I mean, this is differentiating, too, between prairie and forest somewhat, but there's a sort of an overlap, of course.
Right.
The canyons of the Palouse River itself and of Union Flat Creek, and there are parts of other creeks, particularly in Whitman County, and some and the canyons, of course, in Latah County between the ridges by Troy and Deary, all have Palouse Prairie remnants with forested area around them. And I just happened to grow up on a farm that had is half comprised of Palouse Prairie. It's canyon sides that are too steep to farm. And as a consequence, there were all these plants, which as a kid, I didn't notice, other than they were some sort of weed, because wheat was the only thing that mattered, or the cows.
Wheat and cows.
Wheat and cows. But after going around the world a bit and seeing what was happening in those regards, and I came back to my place and noticed how beautiful it is, the native places. I mean, this is what we know, the recreational value of forests for everyone is forests and grasslands and native places, wilderness, if you want to call it that. I mean, some of the wilderness has, been invaded by everything, but it's still got all sorts of aspects that we want to preserve or to maintain, and because of their value, they look beautiful and they feel good, and that's important. Aside from the fact, of course, is the critters that live in them are the things that sustain the whole biology of everything that makes the crops grow. Ultimately, you've got to have bees, and for plants to to mature, we need all sorts of insects. And we need there's bugs that are pests, but there's also valuable ones, and we need those. If we get rid of them, then the plants don't do very well either. That's they're symbiotic in these relationships. So saving what we have left has, you know, many kinds of values. And for me, it was sort of a reawakening then. I became, you know, as the ideas of Silent Spring and from the 60s and on, we've been thinking about them in a new way and thinking that, you know, like, yeah, the there are things we've lost. So when I spent about, 25 years or something overseas, when I came back, then I came back with the idea of revisiting my place and seeing my family and when I got here, I felt a kind of responsibility that I hadn't felt before, I guess, about all sorts of things, about environmental and social questions, about my role in what's happening, that I have some responsibility for, helping make things better, if that's how I think of it at any rate. So as, for example, to preserve the forests and preserve this native prairie that we have in the Palouse. So I worked with the Palouse Prairie Foundation people. There are several groups, of course, that are working on these are prairie things rather than forest things. But and they're doing all sorts of projects now, trying to preserve these and provide education about these species so that people will then see the value of them and see how easy it is really to preserve them. We don't have to, get rid of them in order to, particularly the areas like on my farm where it can't be plowed. Grazing, of course, does, that's hard on some species, of course, but there's still some compatibility there. But there's, the best thing is to, let nature heal a bit, and that's happened by virtue of some economic changes that have taken place at most of these areas that are very small areas in the Palouse. It's not really viable in the economy we have now. It's not competitive to do economics of, say, animal grazing on these remnants because it's not economically productive, and so therefore they're saved. They're preserved in that way from this. There's, of course, the constant problem of invaders where, I don't know how they get here, but, every few years. I've been here back in the States since 1990, so I've watched now over more than 20 years of invasion of plants coming into the native prairie, and some of them we can go out there and get rid of. Some of them have biological controls of insect pests that like to eat them and keep them from taking over. And some of them, have been killed with insecticides or sprays and things like that. That's a last resort, but, if it's getting rid of things that are going to destroy other parts of the environment, well, then I guess we have to do that. That's my feeling about it. I don't like to eat the stuff, but we're already eating very much too much of it. Adding any more is not going to be helpful for sure, but there may be a role for that in terms of working with native prairies. Out at my place now, the Palouse Prairie Foundation have had walks out there with, botanists and biologists from U of I and from WSU and community members who are interested in native plant preservation to look at the plants and find the species that are there. And I was amazed. I had no idea of these. I'd never seen them as a child. I'd walked over them and stepped on them, and a couple of them mm-hmm. I knew, the really spectacular ones, like the arrowleaf balsam root. I never knew what it was called. I thought it was a kind of sunflower, which sort of is.
It sort of is, yes, in that same family. And it is sort of the distinctive flower of this prairie up here.
Mm-hmm. And just a couple of weeks ago, we found out on my place where my dad had got the place in the late 40s, we found some Palouse thistle, which is, of course, you hear the word thistle, well, that's something you got to, you know, we need to spray that.
Yeah, get rid of it. Yeah, that's everybody's reaction. Yeah.
That's what thistles are for, you know. Except this one, it doesn't spread like the Canadian thistle, for example. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's as virulent as the bull thistle in terms of its spreading capacity, maybe a little bit more, in fact, as it does seed itself out. But it doesn't stand cultivation at all, so you don't have to worry about it ever getting in any field. It doesn't occur there, and it has a very distinctive look, and it's a thistle that's here. You know, it's our thistle, and I sort of declared myself to, since we found this. Actually, it's one of the rare plants too of the natives that exist.
Oh, wow.
But it just happens in this drier area out by Union Center and Union Flat Creek Canyon in the middle there and halfway along where it goes off the backside of Paradise Ridge all the way down to Pass La Crosse over there, the creek does. And it's in that where it's deep there in this canyon. It has quite a patch, stretch of it along the hillside. And I haven't looked anywhere else since I only found it a couple of weeks ago. Of this giant patch of, there must be 1,000 of them there, and of course you can say, well, the cows can't eat them, but I mean, there's no way we're going to run cows on there or sheep or anything, because it's just not viable.
Not viable. Stuff. Okay. Wow.
So I guess I'm have a task now to keep the Palouse thistle as a Palouse thistle keeper or something like that. Should be my new designation job or something.
Wow. Well, that is interesting. I mean, most people don't think very highly of thistles, but yes, there are native ones, and they have a place in the system, and some of the drier sites, like you mentioned, that's where they're found. Wow.
Actually, I went out and cut down a patch of Canadians that were impinging on mm-hmm. one part of their range, and mm-hmm. to try to help them keep their place there, because the Canadians are very active and spreading.
And especially when you get a little bit of moisture, they can really take off.
Yeah, this has been a good year for thistles.
Yes, it has. My garden, I know that. That is definitely the case. So you mentioned there's only 1% of the native Palouse prairie left, and some of the things that at least I've been told and I've read from organizations like the Palouse Prairie Foundation, and I want to give a sort of a little compliment to that fine organization trying to protect this remnant. It's just about the rarest system left in the United States, or one of the rarest, that are in terms of native systems, because it's with only 1% left.
Yes, I mean, there may be ones that are even rarer that have mm-hmm. virtually disappeared.
Disappeared,
you can
right.
think of like here, again, they're found only on really high ground, rocky ground, mm-hmm. Steep, too steep ground. So it's, and there's, you know, some places don't have those possibilities of remnants, like in, say, the Great Plains, maybe. They might have wiped out a whole lot of stuff there that's never going to happen again.
Right.
Even
right.
the roadsides are all completely invaded, like we can see, like our creeks. Mm-hmm. All of our creek vegetation must, you know, it's been hit the hardest because of the invasive rhizomous grasses that have really, and the reason those are there is to stop erosion, but of course they don't. I mean, the places where this grass grows is not where that's, you know, not the places where the danger is. The mm-hmm. danger is in the field where it's cultivated, where the soil's disturbed. That's where the problem is, and mm-hmm. you can't put grass there, you know, these heavy grasses there, because
that's where the wheat is.
That's where the wheat gotta go. So it's really hard on the river or on the our wetlands. The vegetation is really hard hit. Less in the more mountainous areas, and the wetlands there, they're in much better condition because they're. But where you get out into the drier areas, what little water there is pretty well sapped up by rhizomous exogenous grasses. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we've seen some of those invaders on some field trips. There was one last night that sponsored by the Palouse Group Sierra Club, Friends of the Clearwater, and with a couple board members, Palouse Prairie Foundation, and folks from University of Idaho, soil scientists and botanist Juanita Lichthart, as well. So that was, I thought, very educational. Well, you start talking a little bit about the mountains, some of the wetter areas, and that's, I'd like to maybe segue into that topic quickly. We don't have to be quick on talking about it, but segue into, again, another one of your passions. You're quite familiar with some of these rarer communities that we have here in the Inland Northwest, what we call the coastal disjunct, basically areas that are wet and appear they're more like the coastal mountains than in some respects than they are the rest of the Rockies. And some of the indicators that we see around here that are fairly common are trees like, of course, the western red cedar, a wetter loving tree. We have Pacific yews. We have a few mountain hemlocks. And in some places, like on the confluence of the Selwyn Loxaw Rivers, they're, although they're not doing that well because of an introduced fungi, are the Pacific dogwood. But there's one area that's that was really unique. A lot of it was drowned by Dworshak Reservoir. But the Forest Service has a research natural area called the Aquarius RNA there, just around where Beaver, I guess Beaver Creek comes into the North Fork.
Yeah, right at the end of the reservoir, the top end of the reservoir is that Aquarius research area. And that's really special. There needs to be some more efforts. Juanita Lichthart, whom you mentioned earlier, did a lot of study on the disjunct vegetation there, the kind of coastal-like plants that are still there in that place. And most of them got covered up by the Dvorak Dam, of course. We're in the lower canyon. But they go all the way up above Kelly Creek in the main canyon and in the side canyons,
yes,
the lowland ones. And that's a particularly critical habitat in the Clearwater, I think, because of this special feature, because of these special plants that are there that are found nowhere else. Again, they have cousins or distant relatives over on the coast. But, you know, for this planet to be kept, we require all of these little variations and long-lost relatives to be accounted for, too. And this is an opportunity for us here in the Clearwater to take that special obligation that we have of seriously making sure that those plant communities survive and that their habitat is preserved so that those plants continue. And, you know, we're not going to get them back by getting rid of Dvorak, for example. That wouldn't work because they're gone. You know, they're upstream, and replanting is, that's a very difficult thing. The Palouse Prairie restoration is impossible. So what we've got to do is save what we've got. And in my mind, there's some particularly critical streams on this route that are unroaded. And this is a very important quality because what roads do and what is bring much more outside stuff in. And that's what disrupts. Like at my farm, you know, some parts of it, blue bunch wheatgrass gets crowded out by all the invaders, not just grasses, but all sorts of stuff comes in there, and it barely holding its own there, you know. And that happens anywhere in any environment that's crowded out by exogenous species. And roading does that really importantly. And to my mind, there's the one creek that's unroaded, the biggest one and the lowest one still remaining, is Wades Creek. And that is, to my mind, the really most significant area of all of those, again, because of this lowland characteristic. And you got to remember, too, this is exactly the place where some of our most important large game species spend their winters down there in those bottom places. And that's, that's their home. That's their stuff. Let's let them let them work there without putting roads up there or trails. And that's what, for me, the most disappointing thing about the study, or what do we call it, the proposal for the
travel plan.
The travel plan for mm-hmm. the Clearwater mm-hmm. National Forest was put a trail, a motor vehicle trail up the Waitis Creek. Well, that's just inviting all sorts of trouble for the forest, for the plants, for this particularly critical habitat, whereas every other zone of it, I mean, there are pockets of it all up and down the river, of course, but to maintain big areas that are completely intact, that are not cut off by roads, and I mean, these plants live right down there, sort of close on the bottom slopes, where they're most subject to damage by that kind of use and subject to invasion. So for me, the most important thing that, you know, I wish could happen would be the closing of that trail up the Waitis Creek and keep motor vehicles out of it. You know, you could say, well, horses go up there and bring all sorts of weed seeds, and people go up there with their, you know, walking and mm-hmm. carrying them too. That's true. I mean, people do bring in stuff, but it's much less. I mean, mm-hmm. And the roads also, they change the environment. I mean, they change the environment for me as a hiker. Mm-hmm. They change it for all the animals that are, you know, their lives are disrupted by that. They don't like it very much. I know there are, you know, dozens of deer down where I live, and they don't like the cars, you know, staring them in the night with those funny eyes cars have. And it's a hard life trying to be an animal around motor vehicles and humans. So the more we can help them out by keeping those areas roadless. And these are just the big animals that we see. I mean, there's hundreds of animals, hundreds of insects and critters out there that we need to take care of too, or the others don't do well.
That's right. You mentioned, you know, Waitis Creek, and there's a campaign that some organizations, including Friends of the Clearwater and the Great Old Broads for Wilderness and Sierra Club, are having Waitis' Wilderness, trying to protect that area to get the motors out. And it would not surprise me here in the next several weeks to see a lawsuit trying to overturn that bad decision that the Forest Service made that turned over most of the backcountry in the Clearwater National Forest to motors. And that was unfortunate, including Waitis Creek itself and the trail up and down there. There is one thing that is interesting, though, and there hasn't been as much use on that trail for one very odd and sort of ironic reason. And that is the bridge that goes to that Waitis campground has been declared unsafe by Forest Service engineers. So they're not letting anyone go there, at least from the North Fork Clearwater. There's that bridge right across the North Fork there, right at the confluence to the campground. They're not letting anyone go across there. If you want to go to that campground, you have to go all the way on the trail. There's that little road that goes to the guard station. Then you have to take the trail down from the guard station all the way to where it comes into the North Fork. And the Forest Service has decided they want to hear from the public. And I think they're saying they're letting the public think about it this summer. They're saying October 1st, the North Fork District Ranger wants to hear from people about what should be done. And in an era of budget cuts, I'm not sure what the Forest Service is going to do.
Well, yeah, I'm going to go up there. I haven't been there for a while. I need to get up there to Waitis Creek and see that and make a submission, because, yeah, I'd urge everyone to do that, because that'd be a big help in the campaign to save that. I mean, in fact, that trail really cuts that whole wilderness right in two. Mm-hmm. And that's a real tragedy, mm-hmm. as well as, I mean, again, my take on it is that it's a critical habitat of a different sort. It's not meant to be roaded. That maybe that was an act of higher powers or something that made that bridge. But
that's an interesting that's true. So we've talked, you know, about some of these wet plants. I mean, some of the things, like there's moonworts. I don't even really know what they are. I guess they're aren't they similar to ferns and kind of more primitive plants?
Yeah, primitive plants. I don't know exactly what they look like either.
And those are supposed to be found.
We do need a look at this Aquarius formation. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a really good thing for us to organize. Would be a tour, an examination of those plants, and maybe Juanita would be interested.
That'd
in
be it, great.
Helping us show it too. That would be, because she's the one who did a lot of work and had a lot of other people involved in working on that.
She actually wrote the latest book, and I use that term both literally and metaphorically, on the coastal disjunct habitat in the Clearwater National Forest. And it is unique. I mean, especially that North Fork country, there's the Aquarius Research Natural Area, and that's where it's probably reached its greatest richness. There's also some that found on the Selway Locks, on those lower parts of the Selway, and the locks on the Middle Fork Clearwater as well, like the Locks of RNA. But the real rich, that North Fork, that's a lower gradient river, and you can go up to places like Wheatus Creek, all the way, like you said, up into Kelly Creek. It tends to still have some of that coastal influence because it's not as steep and has more habitat for fish as well, which makes it less steep and also more for these rare coastal plants.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be really good to have, I mean, some more research about that, you know, to find out what is the full range of it, or, you know, examine a bit more of that. That would be a very useful thing to do. And why not get the people over on the coast to come visit their cousins over here? Maybe
that'd be great.
Find some clubs, groups there that are interested in forest work to come and join us in a kind of examination of it, to look at the you know, to have a special tour of these sites to see these plants and to wake us up to what we got.
I think that's a great idea. That is a wonderful idea. Coastal disjunct. Also, in my mind, it calls to mind some of these little critters that people don't really know much about. I know there's some insects that are rather unique. And I'm not an entomologist, but they're out there. And, of course, there's one that I do know that I've only seen a couple times, and that's that very rare little Coeur d'Alene salamander.
Oh, yeah.
It was named, I think the name is a little bit unfortunate. I think it should be called the Clearwater salamander. I really do, because the research done by Dr. Jack Sullivan, many people know him just as Jack. He's a great character here around town. But he and some of his graduate students and other students looked at the species richness of this salamander. And like you said, it's got its distant cousin, I guess it's what, the Van Dyke salamander.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, over on the coast.
Okay.
And it's fairly close.
The critters, too, let's get them
involved. Let's get them there. This is a little salamander that lives in spray zones and kind of these wetter spots, and it's found in kind of these wetter places from the Selway, Lower Selway, Locksaw, North Fork Clearwater, North. And when they looked at the genetic diversity, they came up with three sort of genotypes based on mitochondrial DNA. And that's the inherited from the mother. They found that there's a unique type in the Selway, which is very rare because it's getting at that southern end of that kind of wetter part. And then the Locksaw had another one. And then the other one was the North Fork Clearwater, and everywhere else points north in the wetter little pockets that go up into Coeur d'Alene, into that southeastern corner of British Columbia, up into there. And the reason that this Clearwater region, again, is so unique, the ice sheets didn't get this far south, and that's where the salamanders came from that repopulated once the glaciers retreated. We don't know enough about them, even how they do it. How they go from these little wet areas to these other wet areas. We just don't know. But yet the center of the species richness, which is sort of their evolutionary center then, is here in the Clearwater.
Yeah.
Well, Ronnie, I was very interested in talking to you about some of your experiences overseas. I know you, when you were in Australia, you did a lot with some of the different organizations over there and helped organize some collectives and whatnot. But you were mentioning something that was interesting, an article, and but I'm going to let you take this where you want to, about the Papuan problem. And that's that big island there, I guess, north of Australia. Am I sort of describing it correctly?
And New Guinea, yes.
New Guinea is also another name for it.
Yeah. I should start by saying I've lived in Australia for about, 17 or 18 years or something. And I've lived 10 years of my life in Indonesia, where I've taught mostly about political science. And I work also with political prisoners and families of the disappeared, political questions and about social change there. But I've also, of course, always watched what happened in the environmental things. Being a farm kid, I sort of... like my plants and my, the outdoors part of the world is of special importance. And of course, in places like Indonesia or specifically in New Guinea, the Indonesian control of the west half of the island was a reflection or is a continuation of a Dutch administrative unit that included all those islands there, were consolidated into a single administrative unit. About 100 years ago, that part was sort of annexed to the rest of Indonesia. And the Papuan people have come to see themselves as a different people and have a nationalist movement. And they see themselves as physically different and are treated by the Indonesian population as a different population also. And the word Papua is actually from a language of an Indonesian kind of language. There are many, many languages in Indonesia, one of that family. The Papuans themselves speak a different, total different family. They're completely different origins, at least linguistically.
And
also... genetically, clearly they are too, because one of their features is they have their hair is what's called pua-pua, mm-hmm. which means kinky or okay. curly. It's kinky like African hair. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's called New Guinea, of course, because the first Europeans went there. They came along the coast and they said, oh, this is like Guinea Coast in Africa.
Africa. Okay, so that's how the name.
But locally, they became known as Papuans by a group in some of the eastern Indonesian islands, went there to... actually to collect these Papuans to turn them into slaves. And that sort of relationship is maybe the way we should characterize the relationship even to this day, sort of in the way that, say, the remnants of Europeans' relationship with Africa has some of the similar kinds of problems in mm-hmm. treating people as slaves and as in inferiors and controlling them in those kind of ways, leads to some very serious problems. In this case, namely, the Papuans don't really appreciate the Indonesian overlordship and want to run their own place. And so they've been fighting a war about that. And of course, working in this area of human rights that I have been, of course, I've been looking at human rights in Papua a lot. But when you get to Papua, you can't help but look at the environment because... the island has, very, very few roads, it has airports all over, mostly built by missionaries, in fact, by Western missionaries.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In the high mountain areas. And so most of the Papuans also have become Christians of one sort or another. And indeed, one might say that those church networks are their government in a way, because that's the connections that put them together as a people. As it were, against the Indonesians in a way, and the foreigners sort of get involved in this kind of thing too. We do it in all sorts of places where there are Christians. We sort of try to work with the Christians that have been made Christians by Europeans or Americans or whatever. Any rate, I've been to Papua three times. to West Papua, and that's the what the local people call it, and that's it. It's been called various things. It's called by the Indonesians. It was called that Papua. It was renamed that, and I had a role in that, which is one of my greatest political accomplishment on the planet has been to. I was a good friend of a man who became president of Indonesia, a Muslim cleric, actually, a Muslim kind of Ayatollah kind of person, who in 1990 became president. He was president for 18 months before they finally impeached him because he, sort of like Jimmy Carter, he sort of had funny ideas about caring for people in ways that most politicians don't.
If you care for people, you don't last very long.
No, you don't last very long. And he didn't. He wanted to prosecute the army for killing people and things like that. And that doesn't work.
That doesn't work. Okay.
Doesn't work anyway. Any rate, before he became president, I met him with some friends. We were talking, and you talk about all sorts of things. And he was he'd been very liberalized. He's a sort of a very modernist kind of person, and very, very, you know, Muslim man, very devout believer, and politically Muslim too. He was a head of a large organization, something like the Catholic Church in our own society, the sort of the main big body of Christians, old style, if you will. But on the other hand, with also the very high ethical things that, say, church policy would regard. Yeah, I mean, again, of course, there are all sorts of exceptions to this, you know, policy toward women and, you know, Christians and Muslims have problems with that. And so he actually was quite different. In fact, he was a believer in women's rights. He'd been to the States a couple of times, but he actually studied in Baghdad and in Cairo. And he learned modern Western liberal ways, and he thought, you know, like women should have the same rights as men should have, which is not an old-fashioned Muslim one, or if we think about the Catholic hierarchy, that's not the way you do things. But very sort of very modern kind of person and very respected because he was, you know, impeccably moral. In all things, you know, there was no corruption about him of any sort, and he went blind. He was going blind when we had this conversation. But I remember one night we were talking, and I'd written an article, or a couple of friends and I had written an article in Australia about how the Indonesians could persuade the Papuans to think more, to want to be Indonesians. It's sort of like how to make it so that, you know. People that we excluded in our own society could be treated better and made to feel more included in their society, in our society, like that. And so we wrote a number of things. And at one point I said, you know, one of the things you might do is you could call the people what they call themselves. Don't call them nigger or don't call them, you know, some word of derogatory word you've made up for them. Mm-hmm. But call them by what they call themselves. And then, you know, call them by their name, you know. And then they'll be friendlier. You know, they'll
That's
think
probably
that,
true.
That, you know, a little respect goes a long way. Mm-hmm. All right? And he said, yes, that's a good idea. When he got to be president the first year of New Year's Day, he was standing on the border, the far eastern border of Indonesia, which is in the middle of New Guinea there. Mm-hmm. And when the sun came up, he declared that the name of the place was called Papua from then on. It wasn't called by the old Indonesian name from before. It was called Papua because that's what the people called it, and that's what he said.
Wow.
And I never talked to him after that, so I didn't meet him after that. I didn't have occasion to, but it's possible that he got that idea from our suggestion. Any rate... Go back to the Papuans and their forests and their what's happening to them. Mm. Okay. So their forests are quite important because there's how many board feet of timber is there? You know, like it's all this tropical hardwood. It's wonderful.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy. Yeah. It's probably in the world market, it's probably very valuable.
And there are overseas Chinese all across Southeast Asia that are running companies and all across Indonesia that want to set up logging companies and go in there and just get what they can. And to get a license, the process is a little, you know, it's a little bit looser than ours, but There's some of the same kind of problems with it, in that sort of favored interests get special treatment oftentimes in these deals. And there, you know, bribing politicians is an older habit, although I was talking to a friend earlier today. She said, no, we've always had corruption. We just didn't talk about it before. Now we don't call it corruption even now, but bribing politicians by campaign donations used to be called corruption. When I was a kid. I thought that was corruption.
Well,
I guess, there's a bit more of that, especially about these forest deals. And especially when the Army was in power, the Army was sort of, you know, controlled everything everywhere. And so if you wanted to cut down some trees, well, you'd just do that, you know. That was an easy way to get to the forest, was to, and the Army needed the money, of course, because they could use that money for their own private pleasure, and they did. And at any rate, so they gave them... there were lots of concessions. That there's a new government, that the process is greater. Now there's a more local government authority, but, I mean, and we know this from our own experience too, oftentimes local politicians are under severe pressure to make the kind of concessions that are by the local moneyed interest, or in the interests of the local moneyed peoples. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact of politics everywhere on the planet, and that prevails there now more so. It's even worse than when the military was in power, of cutting down the trees. And this is what's happening to Papua. They're cutting them down as fast as they can, of course, and pushing roads wherever they can to get them and all the rest of it. So that's, I mean, is a great disappointment. But there's also some, you know, the population has not given up on its idea, and they... of having the infection of thinking they are what they are, and this idea that they are different from the outside invaders is something that it arises all sorts of places. It arises here when we have, you know, some of us think about Walmart as a, you know, killing local business. Well, that's sort of the locals saying we need to protect ourselves against these outsiders who have certain advantages that we can't compete with fairly. And we need to do something about that. We need to have some local sovereignty and run our own show, you know. That kind of thing is how the Papuans look at this. And once that idea gets into your head, it's pretty hard to keep out, you know. And we all have this. And wherever we are on the planet, there's those kind of feelings. So Papuans have those too. Any rate, Gary was mentioning that I was telling him a story earlier today, and it was about... They have a system of dealing with this Papuan problem, these Papuans wanting to have their own, run their own country, as it were. And the Indonesians say, well, let's set up a collaboration, what they call this.
Stakeholders, uh-huh.
You know where they learned this term, of course.
Yes.
And this is what's so depressing about me. How influential American imperialism, in terms of our worst practices of political corruption that we invent here, of how to trick the public, how to get around things, how to maintain control by moneyed interest, and so on. All these kind of things that plague us now and are running our country into the ditch completely. They're also applicable anywhere, of course. And the World Bank, one of our puppet tools, is, you know, running all sorts of education programs. So we have charter schools in Indonesia now, and these kind of collaboration parent instead of parent teachers things. Oh, get rid of that stuff. We don't want parents and teachers. Those are problems when you're dealing with education. I mean, what do we need those for? We need the ones who are the real stakeholders, like the businessmen who are going to employ these kids. They're the most important, of course, everywhere. We know that. We learned that since Ronald Reagan taught us that. and all these other kind of, you know, people who have interests in what's going on here, like the textbook publishers, and there's a whole raft of them that are stakeholders in running school. Bill Gates, he's a big stakeholder in running schools here in Idaho now, since we're all going to have computers, and Bill Gates runs every one of those, doesn't he?
Well,
Bill Gates has been very helpful for destroying American education. And he's done a really good job right here for us and here in Idaho.
Wow.
Any rate, they're doing that. They're doing that there, and they're doing it in Papua. Not so much because, I mean, even having schools, there's large areas that don't have schools now. Mm-hmm. Although they've been, you know, their schooling has spread widely across the country. But when people want to run their own show, they have the government has set up a collaborative, as I said, to try to discuss the problem at sort of the big level, you know, at the national level. And so they have who are the stakeholders there? Well, there's the Papuans, of course, the people who live there. And most Indonesians call them Papuans. It's like, you know, we have these euphemisms or terms for our minority peoples or peoples who are not part of the mainstream, and that's part of this distinction of making it that way. Is by the different kind of treatments that's meted out to people and the kind of sovereignty that they do have. I mean, peoples like the Papuans don't have sovereignty. If they did, things wouldn't be like they are. They'd be very different. The Indonesians say, well, they don't know how to do things because they're not trained well. And that, you think of the way that, I mean, this is the old colonial argument that's been running everywhere. Kids don't know how to do things because they're, well, and some things they don't know how to do, and you help them with those. Yeah, but you don't sort of, you know, direct their every bit of life because they're kids and they don't know how to do one thing, you know. You got to, we have an equality that can be achieved if we want to practice it. But this thing about stakeholderness is has nothing to do with that.
It takes the concept of citizens and sort of turns it on its head in a way.
Yeah.
Because stakeholders, like you said, you've got the timber industry, the mining industry, and all these others out there. Then there's the people.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Ronnie, looks like we're getting close to the end of the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I really want to thank you. It's always very enlightening and interesting to talk with you. We're going to have you come back on here in the future because there's been some interesting new books coming out of Australia about some of these environmental issues, and I'd like to have you, maybe we can do a book review.
Maybe people know Tim Flannery is a Bill McKibben said he was the most literate environmentalist writing today, and he's done a new book called Here on Earth, which is an optimistic one. It's trying to say, we can do things, and there's all these political impediments, and those are the main ones, always everywhere. But we can, we can do this. We can do this.
Well. Thank you so much for coming, and we'll have you back. You are listening to KRFP Moscow. A little bit on the weather. Well, there's been a little update. It's now 88 degrees at the Moscow Pullman Airport. And the forecast, though, highs tomorrow in the mid-90s, about 93 now. So it went up a couple degrees in that hour. Friday, 89, and Saturday, 89, and Sunday, high of 86. And the chances of thunderstorms went up just a touch Saturday night. Now they're projecting about a 40% chance here in the Moscow Pullman area, and Sunday night a 40% chance of thunderstorms. So that is the weather. You are listening to KRFP Moscow. Now we're going to switch gears here and go to some underwriting announcements and Between the Lines.
KRFP thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
Yo, this is the original Dariku Squadron. KRFP Moscow, yeah, let's go.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sanjeev Berry of Amnesty International, who talks about his group's call for an immediate arms embargo against the Syrian government and other actions to reduce the violence in that war-torn nation. Journalist and author Mark Hertzgard, who assesses the worsening weather and environmental conditions connected with climate change, and a new group he's organizing called Climate Parents. And Robert Scheer,